Some of you are here for the Vimalakirti Sutra Book Club talk. Raise your hand. So all the book club members are here? Most? Who's missing? Okay. See, Kevin, that's right. Ron. Ron has been joining consistently?
Half.
Okay. How's it going, by the way? It's good? Okay. Okay, usually this Monday we have two sittings in Q&A, but because we have this book club, and people are sharing, discussing ideas, reading about this particular scripture, and this is an opportunity to kind of wrap up the discussions. And I have printed some questions that people raised. These questions were sent to me by one person, and I haven't taken a look at them yet. Very, very busy this past weekend. I was designing a funeral for someone, and modifying it, tweaking it, and performing it. So I was quite busy, plus doing work that I have. So maybe we should start with people's experiences in this book club so far. How many sessions are left?
Two
more. Okay. Have you gotten to chapter 8 yet? 9? Okay. All right. The back, the rest of the chapter, it could run through them very quick. But there's certainly more to the discussion. There's a lot. You can go in depth. If you finish early, you can kind of go back to some of the chapters and discuss more. But I'd like to hear some feedback. I've heard from one person, but if you have something to say, please say it. So I'd like to keep this session, unlike kind of regular Dharma talks, which is just me talking. So if you want to share some ideas, here's the parameter. Some of the teachings in the Vimalakirti Sutra that really struck you, very important, that helped you or given you some insight on things that you have never thought of or you have thought of but made sense. And some of the points of confusion you're not aware of, you have questions about. And your personal experience with the format of this book club. Right, so you can share on any of these. And if you want to share on something else pertaining to book club, that's fine too.
So, real person.
What's that?
It's written about a real person.
Was it?
Suppose
it. Yeah. Who knows is real?
Some of them are real far-fetched, like in the beginning of it, well, every time something happens, they're like 100,000 gods.
Yeah. Mahayana Sutra is filled with literary tropes. In other words, there are conventions, certain literary conventions that are part of a particular scripture. That's for all the Mahayana text. They are not the main points of the scripture. They are the kind of sprinkles that makes the text prominent, important. If a teaching is given and there's a lot of people present, it must be important, right? Or certain settings must be important. So you can consider them literary tropes. conventions. Like Shakespeare, when he writes a play, there are certain things that are on the outskirts that sets up props for certain message to come across. They're props. Yeah. So don't get too caught up with, you know, are the gods real? These devas flying around in the sky while the Buddha is giving teaching. That's like, here's a very funny story. I'll share this with you. One time I was in San Francisco giving a teaching. And she knows what's coming. So a person comes into the talk, sits down, and starts to get, it's very antsy. You know, it was a half-day retreat workshop type of talk. So it gets looking around, even though they're not supposed to look around, so it's kind of caught up. And even when I was giving a talk, I was reading something. While I was giving a talk. And you're not supposed to read. The noble silence is a part of a retreat. So this person is getting caught up with all the other things. Everything except the Dharma talk. Except the teachings. You know what I'm saying? So that would be like getting caught up with the trappings, the problems. Why is it Buddhist? And when I asked for questions, do you have questions about the nature of the talk? Was asking about why is the Buddha statue, it's like all these other things, you know? And later on, I came up to him and said, what were you reading? He says, oh, I was reading something written by you. It's like, I'm right here. I'm right here. You don't have to go to the text. You know, the text, the article, that's dead. Dead words. It's like, well, I was trying to understand you. Just here. Understand me talking as opposed to reading something about you to understand you while the guy is giving a talk. It's like going to an opera, right? And the performers are performing and you're reading about the nature of opera. About the story. Just perform. You watch the performance, you see? So when we read a scripture, the text, we don't get too caught up with the external trappings, tropes, and conventions. Get to the heart of the teaching.
Some of the words, I didn't understand a lot of the words, so I was trying to go through it, like you said, instead of looking them up and whatnot.
Yeah.
At least the first time.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. We can get a general impression from the teachings. Just the gist of it. That would be a fine way to do it. To get the gist of it. Location, maybe. Different kind of stuff. Just get to what Vimalakirti is trying to say. So that would be my response. But what about like others?
It's interesting to me how in chapter 8, Vimalakirti talks about how the things that manifest him are all like his senses. His father is skillful means and his mother is compassion and kindness. And so this whole entire setting comes together to manifest the Bodhisattva Vimalakirti. And it was also interesting to me that he manifests things like anger and things that we traditionally think of as like not helpful. Like he manifests his stupidity, but of course, with all these things, he talks about manifesting with skillful means, and it's somehow different from maybe when I manifest anger or things like that. But it was hopeful to me to see that even people of his caliber still manifest those things, but they're somehow different. And I'm not entirely sure I understand the difference between his manifestation of stupidity versus my own.
What do you guys think? Those of you who are going to the book club. Jim, are you participating? No? Okay.
Well, there's manifestations of ignorance with wisdom, and then there's just manifestations of ignorance.
Okay, so you're saying the point of departure is the wisdom. Yeah. Okay, anyone else? Carl?
I was struck by, in the earlier chapters, there seemed to be a repetitive focus on generating an intention to proceed with wisdom, to see things from a point of view that would inform as the conditions play out. And that seemed to just be a very repetitive focus. And then as we moved into it, there were, again, the calling forth of the hundreds of thousands of this and the huge expanses of time and the uncountable thrones. And we were aided in our discussion a lot by thinking of all of that multiplicity, those incredible multiplicities, as being representative of the incredible infinite number of vexations I'm capable of generating and experiencing, and how they're just all different aspects that can come up in a person's life. And then the later chapters that we looked at, and this talks directly here, is that it seems, it was pointed out again and again, that virtually anything that I put a characteristic onto, that I assign an attribute to, is going to generate a duality, and that every darn one of them can be a path through the gateway. And basically, it's so reassuring again, point I took away from our previous book when we were looking at the Rosa Lotus Sutra, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was that every one of us, on the slightest bit of awareness of this project, this Buddhist project, awareness of Dharma, that seems to give me my inheritance, I forget the word they used. Everyone wanted to have their
inheritance.
The
prophecy.
Prophecy, yes. And it would unfold.
Mm-hmm. All beings are destined to Buddhahood.
Right. And so totally reassuring that just the slightest bit of contact with Dharma,
mm-hmm,
basically seals my fate. And here the great reassurance is that everything that happens in my life is going to cultivate that. Even if I'm not actively engaged in working with it or not, it still will push me along through that gate.
Mm-hmm.
So I just came away with a great, I've been coming away with a great sense of reassurance and a further reminder that this is something that is within all of us, and that it's just a matter of
time,
allowing it.
time and effort.
Effort and experience, and just, though, an attitude of allowing it to flow, and it will.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very reassuring, and it's been a remarkable time to be able to discuss it with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed every time we're done that here we've had 6 or 8 folks here in Tallahassee, Florida, in the United States of America, looking at these seemingly impenetrable sutras, and yet all coming away with something of value from it that we can utilize in our lives. And we seem to all agree on that, that we're at the end of every session, it's like, wow, that was pretty cool. So glad to be doing it. Thank you. I don't know.
Yeah, Fred.
So I think it's chapter 9. Really, the big lesson is that we're really lucky to be humans and being able to go through this. You know, we are free Buddha has to really give all these strict teachings and, you know, be very stern with people, and sort of goes on about, you know, just how they have to try to deal with us because we're so unruly. And yet, we have the opportunity to become enlightened because of that. We have that option, that freedom to reveal to ourselves our real nature. And so all of the bodhisattvas are like, wow, you mean there's a land like that that's so interesting, and people don't just sit around bored and, you know, purified like we are here? Well, we want to go down with you to see what that's like. And so they take the fragrant food with them that will be provided for all of us here that never ends. I don't know, it seemed like love to me, you know, it was kind of a endless capacity for mercy and for freedom. And they come down to visit Shakyamuni Buddha and all of us. And so the idea that everything we face is a teacher for us, kind of what you're saying, Carl. You know, when we have our anger comes up and we do things that we wish we hadn't done, well, we see it, we understand it, and at some point it doesn't have to be like that. We can just dissolve it before it happens. And so we can't get discouraged, we can't get down on ourselves or others, and that we see everybody as a bodhisattva who is our teacher, even when they're doing things that really make us mad as hell or whatever, that allows us to see our own patterns, our own ways, and to learn to dissolve those.
Anyone else?
Just as an addendum to that, he says how the lotus flower grows in the mud, not like in this pristine environment. You know, the work is done in the mud and the dirt and the grime that is our day-to-day life.
Yeah. Derek, you're part of the group, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the chapters were hard to understand, but I could sympathize with the Shariputra character in that he kept thinking and doing the wrong thing and getting corrected.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really good lesson in not having solid ideas about things. And anytime he did have a solid idea, it was taken away.
Yeah.
And he was left groundless. And they kept going back and back on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to keep that in mind when I get a fixed idea of this is what work is, this is what day-to-day activity, this is what other people are, just sort of letting go of fixed ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we certainly have a lot of notions about things. And Vimalakirti Sutra basically deconstructs every one of them. Notions of innumerability, vast number of being, but can be easily reduced to small. Right? Notion of greatness, and then smallness, notions of distance, far and near, notions of attainment, and vexations, notions of samsara can't possibly be, you know, the playground of some of nirvana, yet this is the Buddha land. You know, while all the Buddhas have their own, you know, purified lands, Shariputra asked the Buddha, hey, where is your Buddha land? You know, it's right here in samsara. Right? So every notion, even gender. So in that sense, that sutra is very progressive. But the main point is emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not vacuity, but intimately threaded in every fiber of our being and our endeavors and all of the senses that we experience. That this freedom is everywhere, presenting you, revealing to us the truth of liberation. That is the theme of the sutra, the gate of non-duality. Right? when there's no other or notions or ideas and so on, there's also no self. When there's no self, these things also dissolve away. Right? But very often we go through life with fixed ideas of things, stories that we tell ourselves, and we're pretty convinced. Things we try to get away from. Right. All the arhats, the disciples, try to get away from. Right. And in the sense, whatever we try to get away from, whatever we try to get, all of these in the multitude of manifestations are really a sense of attachment, a really manifestation of attachment. Soon as you try to get away from something, we reify it into a thing. We make things come into being. We make problems and sufferings come into being by reifying them into a thing. Yes, I have a problem. Soon as we create that narrative, that story, it becomes a problem. There's an obstacle. Who's having it? Me. I'm having that problem. So whether the story is pleasant, whether the story is kind of unpleasant, whether we try to attain something, whether we try to get rid of something, it is our reification, in other words, attachment, that makes it solidified, congealed. Right? And Vimalakirti is going to come and slash it away. It's a wonderful thing. But how this applies to our life is really how we actually view people around us, how we view ourselves, right? How we view our own addictions, how we try to overcome our addictions, right? Our attachment, the way we captivate it by this and that, then we get stuck. Was it Shariputra or Mahakashyapa that was trying to get away from the Naga king?
Girl? Like that, yeah. Or when the goddess released the flower.
Yeah. So it's, you know, as soon as we reify into things out there, we become opposed to it. You know, but this is in fact how we live our lives. I mean, you can really apply this sutra. Don't get caught up with the, you know, this and that, the symbolism, this and that. But really, like, what are the things that we are addicted to, captivated by, that we can't get away from? And the harder we try, what happens? The more prominent we find ourselves in the midst of it. Right? Isn't that true? Right? And then afterwards, for example, if we're addicted to something, we try to get away from it, and then the issue with kind of human, the wonderful thing and also the predicament of human beings is that after we engage in the things that we try to resist, well, first of all, we resist something, and then we always find ourselves doing that. And then afterwards, we can objectify ourselves as an object and critique it. We can make ourselves into someone bad with a narrative built about ourselves, and we feel guilty about it. And then we feel bad, you know, I shouldn't do it, you know, maybe alcohol, I can't do it, it sucks, but I love it, you know, right? Or after we do it, we feel guilty about it. See? So we reify the actions that we do, we objectify ourselves into a dualistic opposition, and we oppose ourselves. See, it's a horrible thing. But the wonderful thing is, the mind is so fluid, it can do everything. It can make ourselves so miserable. Isn't that wonderful? By creating like these things, and yet instantaneously, we can free ourselves. Maybe some of you haven't experienced that, but some of you have. You know, the daily life. You have a little problem, and all of a sudden you found out something good happened. Really? Oh, wonderful. You've forgotten about the previous moment, what happened. Your mind can change like that. That is the intrinsic freedom. But the more we get absorbed and sucked into this narrative, then bondage. So, but all of our, the wonderful thing, circling back, all of our bondage, what we formerly seized as obstacles, difficulties, challenges, problematic people in our life, all of them present us with the opportunity to free our minds, to free ourselves. I haven't been lying to any of you, right? My teaching, the things I keep on saying, it's all good, it's all good, it's all good.
It's all good.
It's all good. If it's not good, that's the problem. Why isn't? It's not being oblivious, blinding ourselves, convincing ourselves it's all good, the world is at peace, there's no problem. It's not that. There is problem, but it's precisely because of the difficulties that draws out our resources that we can change our views, we find solutions, and we attain Buddhahood. So it's those beings who are sheltered from difficult people, challenges. They don't get the full flavor of nirvana. The flavor of nirvana is the greed, hatred, ignorance, and the samsaric tendencies. And it's freedom. And their freedom. Right? So that's why those beings in other pure lands, their teaching is through fragrance, or some other lands is through sounds. And all the sounds are so conducive to awakening, to cultivating this quality, that quality. They have no challenges. So their attainment of Buddhahood, slower. Right? Same thing with Amitabha Buddha. The pure land, there's, you know, all things are expounding the Dharma, the good kind of Dharma, you know, things that go smooth, like the birds are chirping, Dharma, 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 you know, the rivers are flowing, and the wind blows through the trees, and everything's flowing out, melodic sounds of everything's impermanent, all things are empty, you know. So you hear that everything, you are surrounded by Buddha Dharma. So you're kind of drunken in the flavor of the wine of this Buddha Dharma. Right? So for chan practitioners, Buddha Dharma is a difficult boss. Your partner that, I don't know, fell in love with someone else, dropped you. Your best friend dies. Your parent dies. You die. And then you come back to life, you know? Have the fortune. All of these difficulties. And also, you know, your bills, things you gotta do. That is with the flavor of Buddha Dharma. So only by exposing yourself to this and reigning in these things, fully avail yourself to all sentient beings, to all form of sentient beings, you inevitably establish a karmic tie with them. Even though your tie is, you may sentient being yell at you, scold at you. Wonderful. This means I will meet you in the future. Definitely. Because you've scolded at me. Karmically, we're tied. Great job, Jimmy. You know? That's the path. If you don't have karmic affinity with sentient beings, you will not deliver them. They will not encounter you. Walking down the street, it's like two people just walk right past each other. That's why Buddhahood, requires the bodhisattva path. Right? You have to encounter, you have to meet all kinds of difficulties, and you have to use that, utilize that as your resources to practice. So you may be an addict, you may have difficulty, you may have personality problems. Wonderful. They become your source for saving all beings. Because if someone doesn't have that, someone is not an addict, talking to an addict, they have no idea how to relate to the other person. It takes an addict to save an addict. So sentient beings in different life forms, in different capacities, have gathered. This is what in Buddhism called acquired wisdom. Acquired wisdom. Out of the 10 paramitas, the first six we're usually exposed to, you know, generosity, patience, precepts, diligence, you know, and meditation, and, you know, wisdom of emptiness. But the last four, one of which is knowledge, another type of wisdom. What kind of, is that the same kind of, like emptiness? No, that's the wisdom of all beings, of all situations, that can only be acquired in time by you putting in the hours, punching the clock in samsara, here again, you know, and then encountering difficulties, difficult people. That's the only chance. So usually, you know, at Dharma centers, you know, everything come, everyone come and get your moments of bliss, and you go home. It's not really a Dharma center, at least not in the Chan Zen tradition. Dharma? Let's go to the Karni homeless shelter. Let's do our time there, punching our clock. It's easy to save beings, to save people that already come to the Dharma center. They already bought it. They're already buying the story of Buddha Dharma. You see? Everything the teacher says, someone sits here, anyone is substitutable. Guagu, get rid of Guagu, have someone else sit here. Talk some beautiful thing about Buddha Dharma. They're like, yeah, yeah, Buddha Dharma. It's like, what is that phrase? Singing to the choir? You got, where's the choir? You guys are the choir. You got to encounter people that are difficult. My teacher used to put me in situations like this. You know, some corporate company, businessmen, they want to figure out how Zen can help them make more profit. So who to send? The monastery. Head monk? No. Send Guagu there. Like, me? Why? Why do you send me there? I have no idea. I'm in my 20s, you know. I have no idea how to relate to these guys. I go there, they see my master is very famous. He's world renowned. And he sends this young 20-year-old. It's like, what, do they look down on us? Or why is he here? Are you the attendant to someone else that who's here? I'm like, that's me. It's just me, you know? Or hospitals. You know, hospitals. That was a volunteer thing. You know? Everyone had to sign up a hospice program, visit patients that are dying. First of all, the patient didn't even ask for us. We just volunteer. So I see all these blank spots because my fellow Dharma brothers and sisters, they've gone there. They know it's hard. It's embarrassing facing someone who's dying. You're speechless and you're in your 20s and you're there. You just begun Buddha Dharma practice not so long ago, not too long ago. So you sit there. It's a very uncomfortable feeling because whatever you've learned is not your personal experience. You're a parrot. You're repeating what you've read, and you're repeating what your teacher said. So my teacher wants to put us in that situation, face the dying. Face the people that motorcycle accident, strong, young, but no legs anymore. Pissed off. Anger. He doesn't want anyone to comfort him, telling some Buddha Dharma. We used to face Christians who are dying. First of all, it's Christian. It's like, why the hell are you here? Sorry, I'm here to bring some comfort. Get out. Yeah. So we have to have a very thick face. well, I feel we can have a talk. Oh, yeah? Here's what I want to talk. One time I sat down and said, my husband cheating on me while I'm having terminal cancer. Look at me. My hair is fallen. Am I beautiful anymore? No. My child, he wants custody. I'm hearing, I don't know any of this stuff. I'm sitting there like, what kind of Buddha Dharma can I bring to comfort this person? He doesn't want to hear, she doesn't want to hear it. All I could do is, and the more she talked, the more she's in tears. The best way is just let them do the talking. And then all I could do is just held her hand. I couldn't do anything, but monks are not allowed to hold hands with a female. Breaking precepts. My Dharma brother is like, we're both there. He knows he doesn't want to go there, but he's accompanying me. This is monks from America. I want to show them what our Sangha in Taiwan is doing. So he's like, you're holding hands with the female. You broke precepts. And I'm like, I know. I couldn't do anything except that. She was suffering. She was suffering so much pain. I felt the pain. Penetrated me through, holding her hand. When we came out, it's like, I can't believe it, he just broke precept. I was like, broke precept, so I go to hell. And then, at the end, you know, before we exited, I said, because my Chinese, I think my Chinese is okay, but apparently, people in Taiwan, when they hear my Chinese, they know I'm not from Taiwan. You know, it's kind of modified a little bit. So she says, where are you from? I said, United States, you know, 美国. Found out about me, and I told her, nothing I say will help you. But I'm here for you to listen. And just by being present, fully, availing ourselves without the clutter, the garbage that come up, the vexations, like embarrassment, I don't know what to say, pretentiousness, everything, just put it down. Just be with the person. Then that person touched. She felt, what is your name? She said, Guo Gu. Who's your teacher? I said, Master Shen Yan. Oh, yeah, I heard of that monk before. I said, well, I'll see you, come and see you next week. So I left. And next week, she's not there anymore. We don't keep contact with the patients. Every week's different. I figured terminal cancer, maybe died. Who knows? Shows up years later at one of our Buddhist camps for kids. She came up to me. She grew hair. I didn't even recognize her. She have hairs back. Her hair is back. She says, Guo Gu Fa Shi, Venerable Guo Gu. I'm like, yeah? I'm that lady that's in the hospital. I'm a Buddhist now. And I start reading, finding out about your teacher. I said, you divorced? Did your husband get back? I'm still divorced, happily divorced, you know. And my cancer, at least this treatment is over. The segment, maybe it's gone, maybe it'll come back. I didn't ask, but saving sentient beings. Not intentionally, not scheming about it, being honest to oneself. Face vexations. Face difficulties. Accept. Embrace. Respond with genuine things you don't know. You don't know what touches people, what transforms people. It's not what you say, it's not what you do, it's who you are, your heart, where your heart is. It's not Buddhist doctrine, right? So face your addiction. No, I'm not advocating if you're addicted to alcohol, drugs. Guo Gu says, face my addiction, you know, keep on drinking. keep on smoking. You know, whatever you guys do. Or pills or whatever. Or other things, you know. Addicted to certain kind of vexations, you know, craving, you know, desire, maybe anger. Face them and don't come up with excuses. Don't come up with story. Don't try to repress. Don't come up with narratives. Using Buddha Dharma now to repress this thing that you have. So Buddha Dharma is a tool for you to do something. No. You just fully avail yourself to this. Be completely there, mindful. You will diffuse the power of the addiction. Do you believe it? You face it. You're aware of this process. Maybe you use the drink a lot, right? But you're aware of this drinking. You're aware of the taste. You diffuse the power. You're no longer locked into the mode of addiction, but you are observing addiction. And that power of observation, the power of mindfulness, where does that come from? The simple exercise of seated meditation. Wandering thoughts, don't follow, don't reject, aware. Return back to your breath or to your gong'an, to your silent illumination. Some people don't practice this way. Some people are still engaging, grasping, and rejecting. That's not my student. You can't call yourself my student if you practice this way. You're not even the Buddha's disciple, because that's not what the Buddha taught. You have to have the strength, and this kind of strength that you cultivate from not following your narrative about yourself, about others, about things. I mean, grasping, and not rejecting either. And come back to the task at hand. Whatever you're doing, you're sitting, your method. You're working, your work. Your research involving thinking, involving that kind of thinking, mode of thinking. That kind of presence of power will start to become very strong. And you become disentangled from the addiction. See? Most people, when they are addicted to something, they're just addicted. Through and through, they're just addiction. They're just going through the habit. I'm asking you to distance yourself. Watch. Watch your own inability. Right? Like, you don't know what to say to dying patients. You know, you don't know what. Watch this. Don't follow it. Don't say, yeah, I do know so little. I can't help. I'm no good. Follow. You already follow. You see? You're down that path again. You know, there are certain people that are like fighting types. What comes up is not self-disparagement. Oh, I can't do this. No good. The narrative, right? There are some other people that's no good. I'm going to show you exactly how good I am. You know, fighting. So there are certain personalities. Doesn't matter what comes up. You're the fighting type. You're the argumentative type. You're the kind of self-disparaging type. Surrender type, you know. Platitude type. You're the whatever type. Don't give power into that. Watch. Watch. Your well-being rests on your method. That's Buddha Dharma. First, you have to at least see it. Then you can fully embrace. Don't reject it. This is what it is. Buddha Dharma. Come. Here I come, Buddha Dharma, that bottle, or this situation, or that scenario again. That's Buddha Dharma. Here it comes. Prepare myself. Here it comes. Come on. Here it comes. Right? And then fully avail yourself. stronger. I'm just using modern term like addiction, but Buddhism has traditional terms like attachment. Everything can be attachment. Even Buddha Dharma can be attachment. That's what Vimalakirti is attacking. All those people that are attached to Buddha Dharma, whatever way of Buddha Dharma, meditations like the Shariputra always like to sit under the tree. It's like, yeah, tree, pleasant, you know, the wind blows. No sentient beings distracting me. Oh, God. Meditate. Oh, yes. Vimalakirti comes along and says, that's not sitting. That's not samadhi. Right? Magdhagayana, or, no, I'm sorry, Upali, precept number one. He sees some monks break precept. Shame on you. You can't break precept. You can't do that. Right? You can't do that. It's like Vimalakirti comes along. That's not the way to uphold true precepts. Right? They have the capacity for the Mahayana liberation. You don't use the precept that pertains to don't do this, don't do that, to apply to them. Right? For them, you must teach them. Fully avail yourself, right, to your vexations, and then through that, you will reach liberation. Now, that's not justification for you to do whatever you want. No? So, different sentient beings require different teachings. See? So, it's all good. It's all good. Now that you have scriptural basis to back up what, you know, some of the things that we're saying, that's my intention. You see, this is what the sutra says. Lotus Sutra, Vimalakirti, wait till we get to the Diamond Sutra, or the Platform Sutra. You know, the Buddha have one voice, one teaching. Sentient beings who understand it in their own way. And that teaching is the voice of liberation. Yeah. Because different beings' capacity is different. They understand the liberation differently. You know, the Buddha only has one intention, one voice, and that is liberation. Anyone else? Yes, please.
This is not Mark. This is not on the topic so much. This is the third Monday of the month.
Yeah.
And I thought this was the night that you were to bring some food.
Yes.
So I brought some food, and there are some lovely vegetable fritters over here with a slight sort of curry flavor to them. If anybody would like to take some of them home, I have no intention to eat any more of them.
Thank you. You know, we do that, but we send out an email announcement about this special kind of group discussion / talk. So I'm supposed to answer these questions, but for now, why don't you all go get something to eat? And then come back if you want. Those of you who want to come back, we'll just sit and let me see if these questions are not answered already. Archie has brought delicious food. Please, help yourself. We have to recruit you to cook for our retreats,
yeah.
Maybe. How does non-duality and duality interact? They're the same thing. Duality, non-duality. It's the same. Don't make duality, non-duality into duality. The point is, there is no non-duality. Does that make sense? Like duality, non-duality, there's not two things. Non-duality is non-duality. There is no nor is there oneness. Non-duality is not oneness.
I was going to ask about that. It seems, I did a little research on non-dualities, and I was just blown away about all the, it seems like that's the break point in a lot of religions. And once you get to this non-duality, if it's not dual, then it's oneness. That's oneness, and then bam. And but I know in Buddhism we teach to penetrate oneness even still.
Yeah. It's just, this is a kind of apophatic way of saying it's not this, not that.
Right.
So don't start making, well, it's not this, it must be that then. No. Non-duality.
Oh yeah. Well, they never took it away.
So
one thing, I didn't have a wreck.
Be careful, the chair has one leg
It's broken?
No, it has one leg, three legs
oh,
in the water.
So it's neither oneness. Which chapters consider the most important part of the sutra? A lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of sprinkled throughout different chapters, you know? A lot of different chapters. Yes, I mean, chapter 9, yes, is very important, or chapter 8, Gate of Non-Duality. But the other chapters, all the mistakes of the Shravakas, all the mistakes of the Bodhisattvas, their mistakes, they're showing us how to practice. You see? So they're all very important. And Shariputra's being caught up with big and small, far and near, chair so big, how can I get up, what are we here for? All of these things. Relativity, right? Good, bad, all of these things. They're teaching us. The important thing is we have to apply it to our lives. You see? What is the meaning of highly evolved bodhisattvas from the world of fragrance coming to visit the lowly saha world? Well, first of all, maybe they're the lowly. Maybe they're the lowly because we have all the juice of nirvana right here. We have all the ingredients right here. And I don't know, from my memory, I think they were pretty jealous. Right?
They
so,
seem to be sort of bored.
Yeah. We get this Buddha Dharma, Buddha talking all the time, so beautiful and lovely.
Is that kind of analogous, that those two different things, like monastic life and lay life?
There's no set way.
Yeah.
Some monastics live quite comfortably, better than lay.
That's what I'm talking about. They're that higher bodhisattva, that evolved bodhisattva. Maybe.
No, what I mean is the other way.
Yeah.
Like they live a worldly, sensual life. I mean, if you think about it, you take away money issues, you take away interpersonal problem, that's most of our vexations, isn't it? Your partner, wife, husband, take that all the problem away, and you take away all the bills you have to pay. Your rent, your mortgage, what's left? You know, so yet they can practice. The pace of life is good. So they, you know.
Yeah, but then Master Sheng Yin sends you all out to hospice care and send that
to compensate,
you
know, to complement.
Put you out there.
What, you know, his training is you know, to present problems when there are none, create problems. Yeah.
Create problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, we wouldn't be here.
I do.
Otherwise.
And it's not create problem for me. You're teaching me. You're teaching me. No, teaching me all kinds of your wisdom. The ways that you tried, the ways that you live your life. And the strategies that you come up with, the amazing resourcefulness that you have, and forcing me to, as a teacher, to help. How can I help? Or how can Buddha Dharma help? Right? So that forces the teacher to understand Buddha Dharma, that forces the teacher to practice Buddha Dharma, to digest it so it becomes the teacher's Buddha Dharma. not like a parrot.
Well, that's also the power of what we get from
each other.
Each other.
Yeah.
And it's whether it's the board meeting or the book club or going on a picnic or whatever.
Or, you know, dealing with all the issues of applying for the purchasing property, you know, all the zoning issues. You know, now Carl and Fred are experts in Tallahassee zoning issues, you know? So all the forms, the applications of this is where the juice of Buddha Dharma is. Don't ever deny your life. But you must know how to practice. You can't say, don't ever deny me. I'm not going to deny myself of parties. I'm not going to deny myself of things I can do, possibly. Monday night is always going to be there. Guagu is always going to be there. I'm going to do something else on Monday night because I can't possibly deny myself of dance clubs and on Monday nights and, you know, this and do that and alcohol. You can't do that either. Take a look at your life now. The difficulties that you face. This is the workings of karma. This is how it manifests. And this is precisely where you liberate yourself. You know? What does this world have to do with Saha world? Or is it just a trope for the composer? Saha world is basically samsara. Saha world. Samsara. In other words, Shakyamuni Buddha is pure land. Chapter 1. Right? What does fragrance mean? Fragrance means, the way I see it is, Buddha Dharma is not limited to words and language. Stubborn sentient beings who are so caught up in words and language, us, everything that we are, everything that our sense of identity, sense of who we are, is defined, mediated, shaped by words and language. Think about it. What is it not? So for us sentient beings, this is the tool. But for other sentient, it doesn't mean Buddha Dharma is limited to that. Some Buddha Dharma is taught through fragrance, like this, the fragrant Buddha land, right? You smell something, become awakened or something, right? So this means that that's just one among many senses. Don't deny what you see. Don't deny what you smell. Don't deny what you hear. Everything, all of your senses. You know, your family members, you know, your mother, father, they are the wisdom and compassion of Buddha Dharma manifesting. So for them, these beings are caught up with fragrances. So that's their Buddha Dharma. You know? So I mean, one time I remember a boy in Taiwan asked me what should he do? This is a children's Buddha camp. What should he do to, you know, help his pet dog who passed away? Should I read the Heart Sutra? Young boy, you know, not that young, maybe in teenagers. Should I do this? Should I recite some dharani, some mantras? I said, you're going to talk dog language. To dogs, you save dogs. So when you stand before dogs, you are fully through and through dog. When you stand before highly educated people, you are through and through, if you can, you relate to the person. You reflect, respond to what the person needs. You know, so you don't, you know, recite the Heart Sutra for a dog. He doesn't understand, right? What do? You buy the dog's favorite bone that he used to like, and you bury it. This is for you, Lassie, or whatever the name is, you know? This is for you. You see? To a child, that's the wonder of my teacher. He's a first doctorate in Chinese Buddhist history, PhD. Yeah, he's a Chan master. He can talk to governor, he can talk to the president, he can talk to this, you know. To a kid that wanted to learn Kung Fu, 11 years old, tag on his robe, say, hey, just inundated every Sunday in New York, they used to play this Sunday afternoon Kung Fu movies. Mm-hmm. You know the type I'm talking about, right? Where the talk and the voice doesn't go in sync. You heard my brother. I'm going to revenge. You know, like the mouth and the words doesn't match. That kind of Kung Fu. I'm inundated with monks shouting Kung Fu. I tag on his robes. Do you know how to practice Kung Fu? Do you know Kung Fu? I'm talking to a Chan master. He looked at me like, of course I do. I'm like, really? Can you teach me? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you got to prepare. You got to come next. You got to learn meditation first. I was like, okay, I'll learn meditation. No, trick me into learning meditation. So when he's a kid, he's fully a kid. He's like a child. When he talks to the president of some company, he's not like a child, like, hee-hee. You know, he doesn't do like that. He's, you know, educated. He can converse. The mirror wisdom. Right? So to someone who needs fragrance teaching, the Buddha Dharma manifests fragrance. To someone who needs talk about teaching of words and language, talk about words and language. You know, so all these things, all of our senses, fully avail yourself. You must have a method, though. You can't just avail yourself and just end up following them. Right? You try to save sentient beings, and then you become converted by sentient beings, right? Like your counselor, psychiatrist, for example. Someone come to your chair, starts complaining about this and that, soppy life and painful anguish, and then you start crying with them. And then you lose yourself. That's not what I mean by mirror wisdom. The mirror responds to what it needs. It doesn't become that. So bodhisattva are fully in the world, but they're not really of the world. They're not of vexations. They can manifest it, but only to the purpose of saving sentient beings. That's one of the bodhisattva practices. It's called tongxing, means to be with what they do, to do what they do. So parties, go party, you go to party, and then at the end of the day, they become converted, right? As opposed to you go to party and then they convert you. You got drunk, and you passed out at the sofa. That's not what, you know, the mirror of mind is about, you know. So teaching through fragrance, you're not fragrance. Teaching through sounds, you're not sound, but sound is what they need. You respond. See, that's a big difference. Right? Manifesting stupidity, vexations. You don't become stupid. Wisdom is guiding you. Except when the wisdom manifests, it manifests as compassion, identifying with sentient beings and the needs and so on. See? That's all the questions. Yes? You will be, but of course, but you're aware of that. You're aware that you're crying, and you're aware of this mechanism. Maybe your inability, maybe your sadness, maybe your pity, maybe whatever things, you see that. You know, you don't lose yourself in the midst of these emotions. So you're completely transparent, you're honest, and your strength comes from this transparency. That's called mindfulness. Right. Yes, Svetlana?
In this last example you gave, where you meet each person to where they are at, if you can, you meet a dog on one level, a child on another level, an educated person, and so forth.
Yeah, that only depends on sentient beings. It has to depend on how honest one is.
For a practitioner who is doing it,
yeah.
Is it a habit that comes automatically, or is it a choice driven by awareness and direct choice?
They have to cultivate it. They have to hear the Dharma, understand this is how we're supposed to practice. Not yeah, if one's able. It's choice. It always begins contrived. We have to learn this, and it will be awkward, right? Like, for example, but we also have to, that's a great question, because we also have to realize who we are, where we're at. So if you're not capable of saving sentient beings, you put yourself in that situation, that's wrong. That's wrong use of Buddha Dharma. So if you have to put yourself, separate yourself away, and then come back when you're stronger, then you do that. See? It's like playing, you have to know you're a tennis player and you're at, I don't know, level 3. So that's the sentient beings that you save, that you help. You play with players that are level 3. You meet a player that's number 7, level 7. You're going to definitely get delivered. He's going to convert you. You put yourself in that situation, no chance. You see, so you have to know yourself, know others, then you know how to advance and retreat.
In terms of
first of all, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Do you follow?
Do I follow what you're saying?
What I just said?
Yes, I follow.
Yeah, okay, all right.
In this, what you call that they convert you,
mm-hmm. All kind, anything. You're shaken, but you're kind of thing. But even that is still good because you've established some connection. Failure. We label it, reify it as failure, I failed him or whatever. And then you learn, you come to Dharma talk and you hear Guagu says, failures are the ingredients to success. And he says, oh, well, maybe it's not a failure. And then you slowly come back. And whatever situation we find ourselves, sooner or later, just the amount of what effort we put in, the time we give ourselves, becomes sources of our strength, becomes our bodhisattva path. But ideally, you start baby steps. You know, you help out. You first learn how to hold the tennis racket first. You gotta do steady meditation. You gotta cultivate your mindfulness of not being swayed, pushed, and pulled by wandering thoughts. You gotta learn that. Very foundational. That's how to hold the tennis racket. Emotions come up. You gotta learn that. And then you can start to apply to complexity of daily life. Like you're no longer swayed by an enemy or a friend or praising words and, you know, temptations. And you're also not swayed. And then the more contact you have, the stronger you become. Your meditation field becomes samsara. So the Buddha, there's a technical term for the Buddha's samadhi. One among many. Samadhi is usually considered meditative absorption, you know, trance. You know. But the Buddha samadhi is called Yoshi Sanmei, the samadhi of play. Where? In samsara. All sentient beings become partners, teachers, sources, displaying the wonderful Dharma. But in order to get to that stage, you have to not be swayed. Right? So that's why, you know, like last week I was talking about, you know, someone sent me an article, and someone criticizing meditation as, you know, stress reduction, blah, blah, blah. of course, meditation is not only stress reduction. Stress is nothing, you know. Genuine Buddhist meditation is not about stress reduction. This is the path of awakening. Where? In the midst of dirt, in the midst of the swampland. That's where the flowers, lotuses glow. And this becomes sources of your strength. Okay. Did you have a question?
Well, it just strikes me how it seems that no matter what, I'm charged with discovering this for myself. There's no, the teachings don't do it for me. I have to be engaged, struggling with this every aspect of life. And it brings to mind how easy it is to think I've failed at something. It brings to mind the story you've shared of your feeling of having failed your teacher, I think, and you brought it up to him.
Yeah.
And the ability to just let go of it, that was.
What the teacher said in that moment, what he said in that moment, allow me to just put it down.
Exactly. And how easy it is to get wrapped up in it and suddenly believe that it's an absolutely permanent aspect of who I am.
Yeah.
And yet the slightest shift of perspective and it's like, oh,
opening.
That's no longer true at all.
Yeah.
And what an effect that can have of everyone around. I mean your story affected how many it's affected me.
So, you know, okay, Vimalakirti Sutra, wonderful text. You have to apply it to yourself. Don't really like literature. You gotta apply it to your life and struggle with it, work with it, some of the teachings, apply it. Make it come alive. Make it like blood that flows through your body, the veins, Vimalakirti. Right? And next time you attach to meditation, the meditation period is over. I'm going to sit a little longer so I can continue this bliss. You have become Shariputra. Vimalakirti is going to whack, come down with a stick. Right? Okay. Have a good night.